From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Almost 200,000 children in Georgia and over 2.7 million in the United States have an incarcerated parent. It's according to the National Resource Center of Children and Families of the Incarcerated. In Atlanta, the organization Forever Family helps strengthen the bonds between incarcerated parents and their children through programming and visitation. Sandra Barnhill is founder and national president of the organization. She's joining me in the studio. Sandra, welcome.
Thanks, Virginia. So glad to be here.
So something surprising to me, Georgia has the highest probation rate in the country and ranks eighth in the highest prison incarceration rate. So help put that in context. How many families does that affect?
Millions of families. Really, when you look at the statistics, the Georgia Department of Corrections says that there are about 200 children who have a mom and or a dad in prison. So that doesn't include the number of parents who are out there on probation. And that's why I think the number is even higher. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of the things that we've got to do here in our state is to begin to get a firm grasp on how many young people, how many children are being adversely affected.
Yeah, and the families, I guess, replicating, you know, parents, sisters, brothers, all of those affected as well. But many of the debates that we have about incarceration, they're about unequal sentencing or, you know, tough on crime versus cost of incarceration and the personal cost to inmates. Children don't seem to come up much. Why do you think that is?
Because they're considered collateral damage. We don't think about it. In many ways, these children are invisible. Nobody walks around at school and says, hey, my mommy, my daddy's in prison. Nobody at church says, hey, my parent is locked up. Nobody at the grocery store does that either. So it's almost, Virginia, like out of sight, out of mind.
Do you think that those children, those families often even go to great lengths to conceal that their parents are incarcerated?
Yes, because there is a stigma associated with having a parent in prison, particularly a mom. We often say, okay, the parent is a criminal. They've been convicted of a crime. But we also then say that not only are they criminal, but they're probably not very good parents. And I find that statement not to be true. These parents love their children and their children fiercely love them.
Well, we find that data-wise, since 1980, the number of women incarcerated has multiplied sevenfold. So that's staggering. Your organization began with a focus on women and mothers in prison. What kind of resources were you not seeing for this group of people?
Well, the first thing that we saw was the disconnection from their children. And our mission is to strengthen that bond. When a man goes to prison, he often has a real strong support network around him, a mom, a wife, a girlfriend, a cousin, generally females who will ensure that his kids are taken care of. But when a woman goes to prison, often it is only her mom, her sister, her cousin who will get involved. And so we find that overall, fathers in prison, men in prison get many more visits than women in prison. And so part of what we've got to do is to change that, which is really why our organization was created.
So a large part of why was the organization created? What drew you to this?
Two things, really. One, I was a practicing attorney, and I worked with a lot of women in prison on prison condition cases. And no matter what we talked about or no matter what we put in motions, the underlying question from those women was, what about my kids? What about my kids? And so I really realized that the law was not the answer. Part of the answer. But you and I and the rest of the citizens in this state and this country, we are the answer to this problem. We must get active. Yes, we must have laws, but we must see these children for who they are. Beautiful, precious gifts that have every right to grow up to help lead this country. And we've got to make sure that happens.
A large part of the work that you do is organizing and facilitating visitation between kids and parents. Why is this such a big part of your focus?
Because kids often think these types of thoughts. Well, my mommy must not love me. My daddy must not love me, or they would not go to prison. Or oh my God, my mom, my dad's in prison. I'm going to end up there too. We work very hard to dispel both of those statements. These children have a bright future. And again, somebody must invest in them. I was fortunate to grow up in a home with my mom and dad and just had a pretty regular, normal kind of life. Every child deserves that life. Now, whether they're in a two-parent home, that's not the issue. The issue to me is that every child needs to be loved, needs to be encouraged, and needs to know their worth. The caregivers of these children do a good job, but many of them are older grandparents, and they need our community to come alongside them, not to take over, but to support them as they play their important role.
I want to dig into one of the things you said, that children, the belief that children who have incarcerated parents are much more likely to be incarcerated themselves. This is a persistent idea, but the Annie E. Casey Foundation found no solid evidence that that's true, that children with incarcerated parents have an increased risk of being involved with the justice system. Why do you think this idea does stick around?
Because I think that we demonize people who have been incarcerated and by extension demonize their children and their families. I'm happy to say I was a 1993 Annie E. Casey Fellow and actually brought that work to them as one, and was one of the thought leaders as they begin to move into this arena and look at children that have been affected by parental incarceration. And so I'm so glad for the research that they did, because hopefully it will stop some of the stigma.
Sandra Barnhill is with us. She is the president and founder of Forever Family, helping parents with incarcerated children and those children, especially as their parents are going through the justice system. So, Sandra, what are some outcomes for students when a parent is incarcerated?
Well, there are two sides to that, Cohen. The outcome when they're with us, Virginia, is that they do well in school. They're actively involved in extracurricular activities, and they fully engage and take up their leadership, and they develop a stronger and more connected relationship with their parent through visitation. Research, the jury is kind of out in terms of what happens if children don't have visitation. But what I can say from my 32 years on the ground working with over 35,000 young people, they do better when they are connected with their parent. And part of what we do is to ensure that. And when I say they do better, they generally seem much more grounded. Their bonding with school, with family is stronger. Their self-esteem is higher. Those are all of the ingredients that young people need to do well.
Well, so having parents in jail doesn't mean a child is going to someday end up in jail. But people do talk about the school-to-prison pipeline, especially for children of color. First, can you explain what that is?
Sure. Well, unfortunately, in our society, we determine how many prisons we're going to build by looking back at our educational system and saying, okay, by third grade, if this child can't read, that probably is going to be a statistic. That's one side of it. Then the other side, Virginia, is that in our society now, we criminalize behavior that when I was a child just got dealt with. In other words, if you misbehaved in school, you might get sent to the principal's office. Your parents would be called. You would get detention. Now, when you misbehave in school, oftentimes the officers that patrol to protect the school then take you into custody. And you turn around and your child is in the juvenile system. And so safety is important, no doubt. But we are swinging the pendulum too far in the wrong direction. We shouldn't fear our children. We should love them and figure out how to support them, even when their behavior is not the best.
So you talked earlier about, you know, a parent who's incarcerated is not a bad parent. But how can you be a good parent when you're incarcerated?
Well, the first level is to have a commitment to parent your child, even under these circumstances. Our agency has a manual called Parenting from Prison that talks about that. And we say from the moment you walk inside the door, your reunification with your children needs to begin. The first thing that you can do is take every program you can inside the institution to better yourself. The second thing that you can do is make sure you don't get any disciplinaries so that you can continually visit your child. So I think that the way parents can take up their parenting role inside or behind the walls is to make up their mind that they are going to do the time and the time is not going to do them. They are going to come out of this situation stronger, better, more connected to their child, and more clear that they will not engage in any illegal activity that could separate them from their family.
So I was looking at the Marshall Project has done a lot of work on this and some investigative work on parent-child separation. You know, one of their advocates called it the separation crisis that nobody is talking about. But part of it was that how it felt to the parent, the guilt, the shame, how would they face their children and know that, you know, this is a kind of effect that could last for a lifetime. So how do you help them get beyond that? That is a crippling kind of belief system. The worse they feel about it, the more likely they may not be to see their children. Is that true?
That is true. So we have a therapist, a licensed marriage and family therapist, Dr. Janie Francis Asante, who's worked with us for over 20 years. And I support her and agree with the position she has taken. You must tell the truth. We cannot begin to change things in our lives until we face them. And so what we encourage parents to do is to be honest with their child and say, Mommy, Daddy made a mistake. Because I can be a good person and make a mistake. So I made a mistake. I'm being held accountable for my mistake. I've learned from my mistake, and this is how I'm moving forward. And so to be in our program, you cannot tell your child that you are on a mission for the government. Hmm. You cannot tell your child that you're overseas. You cannot tell your college that your child that you're away at college. You must tell them where you are. Obviously, the way you share that is based on the developmental level of the child. What you would tell a 5-year-old is not what you would tell a 15-year-old. But we require that because the only way we can move forward is with that level of transparency and honesty.
And what age is appropriate for a child to visit a parent in prison?
Well, we take newborns. And people might say, newborns? Well, yes, that's very important because once parent separates, particularly a mother, from their child right after having them, the need to be close and have those bonds really affects the child. So as soon as the child is cleared by their physician or medical provider to be able to go out in public, we will take them for visitation. We help pioneer here in Georgia the concept of children's centers, which is a special room inside the prison where the moms get to hold, change diapers, cuddle, play with their children. And it looks like a daycare. And we're so happy to have helped to develop that and think it is so important that in every one of the women's prisons, and there are 4 in Georgia, there is that center, that children's center.
So Doug Patton on Twitter asks, is there any evidence supporting reduced recidivism for incarcerated parents who remain connected with their children? We're up against a break. If you want to start that, or we can hold it until after. I'm speaking with Sandra Barnhill. We'd love to get to Doug's question and your other questions. She is the president, national president, and founder of Forever Family in Atlanta. I'd like to hear what you think. How can we help better foster bonds and connection between incarcerated parents and their children? Is this something you value? Or, you know, maybe you think that, well, this is part of the price that they pay. Let us know. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. We'll be back with Sandra Barnhill after a quick break. Stay with us. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, back with Sandra Barnhill from Forever Family in Atlanta. Her organization helps children with parents who are incarcerated in their families. I want to get to that question that came in on Twitter. Is there any evidence supporting reduced recidivism for incarcerated parents who remain connected to their children? Sandra.
Yes, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which you mentioned earlier, has really put a lot of money towards that question and trying to figure that out. And so here's what the research is saying now. They say a couple of things. One, if a parent has maintained a bond with the child while they were incarcerated, when they come out, they're less likely to recidivate. They're more likely to get a job and to keep it. And so that's an important piece for us. What we are beginning to see through the research is that that connection really does help the person. In our program, our parents have fewer disciplinaries while they're incarcerated based on the simple fact they want to maintain that relationship. One of the issues, Virginia, that we have is not a lot of funding has been put toward researching this area. And so I'm hoping that more foundations and research organizations will follow Casey's suit.
Well, one of the investigative or journalistic organizations looking at that, again, the Marshall Project, and their data, in 1 in 8 cases of parents lose parental rights when they are incarcerated. And for women, it's more than 5 times more likely to have a child folded into the foster care system. So how does Forever Families help unite parents after that, after they're out of prison?
Well, generally, it starts for us once the parent is incarcerated. We are recognized by the Department of Corrections. In the first 30 days, a prisoner is a diagnostic, and they hear about the programs. And so we're one of them. And then they connect with us, and we begin bringing their children. And so most women are in prison 6 years and 8 months. Men 5 years and 3 months. And so during that time, we are helping them to keep the bonds strong. And so once they get out, that doesn't stop. We continue to stand alongside them. We're not taking them, transporting them to visit anymore, but we are supporting them.
So you're talking about what is happening more and more in social services, kind of wraparound services,
yes,
not addressing just one need, but many others. You mentioned women in prison. There was a study published just last week in the Journal of American Health found a growing number of live births among women in prison. No hard data on some reports of giving birth in cells or while in shackles, but still the question of how does Forever Families work with children who are actually born in prison?
Well, we actually partner with the sister organization, Mothering Behind Bars. I recently went to, every month they have a baby shower for women who are pregnant. And what happens here in Georgia is when you are pregnant, you are transferred from your facility to Helms, which is a facility where pregnant mothers are. You get medical care there. You go to what we call the Free World Hospital, have your baby, and then it's turned over. You have, I think it's 36 hours with your child, and then your family or the state takes it. We get involved through that partnership by connecting immediately with that family to say, hey, we will, once the baby is cleared, bring you guys for visitation. And so some of what happens in this work is that they're different organizations doing pieces of the work, and we support one another so that there's a continuum of services and care for these families.
Well, Sandra, you've been doing this for a long time. Just 30 seconds here. What keeps you coming back?
Oh, the love. I'm going to tell you, I have grown tremendously through being involved with these children and their families. My life is so blessed and graced to be able to share time with them, to learn from them, to be a part of their family. And that's why I love our name, Forever Family, because we are forever family now.
Well, so it radiates from you. Thank you so much, Sandra Barnhill, for joining us.
You're welcome.
She's founder and national president of Forever Family, based in Atlanta. Now we're heading into the kitchen for our occasional series, Main Ingredient. We invite chefs to talk about one essential Southern ingredient.
My name is Nolan Nguyen. I'm the executive chef at Banchi. We just opened up about 6 months ago in East Atlanta Village.
But in those 6 months, you've made quite a name for yourself. New York Times mentioned you in their preview of the Super Bowl, named by Atlanta Magazine Best New Chef, and now you're a semi-finalist for the Rising Star Chef of 2019 James Beard Awards.
We, I think more than anything, just got really lucky. We had a lot of people come in right from the beginning, and just they happened to be the right people who liked what we were doing.
But you didn't go to culinary school, right?
I did not. I was on the fence when I was in my early 20s and decided instead I would just try to work my way up and expose myself in the right kitchens. So I was in Athens, and luckily enough, I got a job at 5 and 10, right as Hugh Atchison was rising up, and that was my boot camp, really. I learned a ton there for about 3 years and decided it was time to move to the big city of Atlanta. And so I got a job at 246, and then from there, King and Duke, and learned a whole lot working for Ford Fry as well.
You say you got lucky, but you're also really inventive, known for unique dishes, unique combinations, locally sourced. I know sustainability is a big part of what you do. So what does that mean for you in terms of how you're doing things on a daily basis?
I did not want to adhere to a lot of the rules that I had learned throughout the years. You know, in the winter you do Brussels sprouts and all these things, and there are a lot of trends that I just happened to notice, and I figure, you know, the whole idea behind cooking is being creative and enjoying trying new things out. And so I didn't want to polarize ourselves to just an Italian restaurant or just an Asian restaurant. And so by that, we can do a ton of different things, a lot of different influences and techniques and ideas, and oftentimes they overlap.
So you're originally from Moultrie, Georgia, right?
Yes, South Georgia.
Was it a foodie family?
Yes, but not like the modern term. We grew up on a farm, and so I was definitely close with a lot of produce actually coming out of the fields and what it takes to actually prepare those things. I also did a lot of hunting and fishing as a kid, and by that kind of learned to appreciate food in a different way, actually where it comes from and how to prepare it and appreciate it.
So you chose as your main ingredient peanuts.
Growing up on a farm, one of the things that we would often grow is peanuts. And I remember as a child picking peanuts out of the dirt, washing them off, and then more often than not, we would boil them. And I remember as a kid, every time I would talk to someone from up north or not in the South in general, about boiled peanuts, they thought the concept was gross. And you know, as I've gotten older and a little more well-versed in the culinary world, peanuts are actually not a nut, but a legume. So they're in the same family as lentils and chickpeas and beans, all of which are things that are stewed for a long period of time in water, just like boiled peanuts. So really, boiled peanuts is maybe more of an acceptable way to produce them than roasted.
What are you doing with them?
So right now, the non-traditional take, we're making a savory peanut brittle for a Thai-inspired steak and papaya salad. It's actually on the savory side for a brittle. It has fish sauce and chili flake and garlic, but it's also cooked down and caramelized in sugar, and so it's all the things. It's sweet, it's spicy, it's salty, and it's also just a nice texture on the salad.
So shall we take a look in the kitchen?
Absolutely.
So what do we got going on here?
So right here we have 2 cups of peanuts. We're basically just going to pulse that in a Vitamix until we get the consistency that we're looking for with a couple of other ingredients, and then I'll kind of show you where we take it from there. So right now we have 2 cups of peanuts. This is 40 grams of roughly chopped garlic, 5 grams of salt, we have 5 grams of chili flake, and then 30 grams of fish sauce. This is pretty potent stuff, so a little bit definitely goes a long way.
Maybe you can help us translate grams after this.
There's 28 grams in an ounce. And so, you know, really, I would say chili flake could be probably looking at it 2 teaspoons, probably about 1 tablespoon of fish sauce, 1 teaspoon of salt, and then again, 3 tablespoons of roughly chopped garlic and 2 cups of peanuts. Sorry, that probably
okay.
is a little bit difficult
to
translate to home. Okay. So now we're going to pulse this in the RoboCoop, and we're just looking for the right consistency to make our brittle. This might be a little bit loud. Okay, so right about there is what we're looking for.
So how would you describe that?
I would say it's coarsely ground. We definitely don't want to create any powder because you want all the pieces to be a nice even size, you know, not much bigger than, say, rock salt or something of the like. So now what we're going to do is we're going to transfer our mixture here into a medium sauce pot. And then we're going to add our sugar and water. That is 1 cup of sugar and 1 cup of water. And what we're going to do is essentially caramelize the sugar around the peanuts. And so that takes, I would say, at a low simmer, probably about 20 minutes. You definitely want to keep an eye on it, stir it frequently because it can scorch the sugar. But what you're looking for is to cook out all the liquid. And once that has happened, you're actually ready to go for the next step. And at that point, what I like to do is actually strain the peanuts into a large colander and fry them in the fryer. The reason for that, peanuts are not porous, so they're not going to absorb the oil and become greasy. But when they're submerged in the oil, everything is the exact same temperature. If you make a brittle in an oven, there are hot spots. One side gets cooked faster than the other, and it sometimes lends itself to uneven cooking. If you were going to do this at home and in the oven, I would definitely try to use parchment paper or something like that because it's very sticky, and rotate the peanuts very frequently in the oven so that they'll cook as evenly as possible. But really, that's about it right now. This would take about 20 minutes, and then I can have you taste the final product.
And you insist.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's definitely pretty tasty stuff. So really, the way it should taste is a little bit sweet, a little bit spicy, a little bit salty, a nice balance of all those things, while having a really nice crunch to it as well.
Oh my gosh, it's delicious.
Right? I've had plenty of people tell me that we could jar it and
that.
Sell it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's pretty labor intensive on a grand scale, but it is definitely pretty tasty.
Wow, looks so good.
Awesome.
So all the liquid comes out of that, you strain it, and then you fry up the peanuts. That's why they're a little even more toasty than they were in the...
Exactly,
right.
Exactly.
Because they're kind of a nice, beautiful brown, like a mahogany
brown.
Yeah,
so if you think about it, what we've done is coated the peanuts in sugar. When that sugar hits the fryer at 350 degrees,
right.
It caramelizes. So essentially you're making a caramel that sort of seals all that flavor into the peanut.
But there's nothing sticky in here at
no,
all,
they're
so
not
it's
sticky.
All about
and,
the balance.
And that is definitely a part of making sure you cook them long enough, and we also let them cool for a really long period of time so that they'll kind of firm up and be nice and crispy.
Wow, okay, so then what do you do with that? You said you put it on top of a papaya salad with steak.
Yeah,
steak
so we have, right now it's green papaya, which is not ripened. It's a little more bitter than ripe orange papaya.
Can I ask you something? Because I've always been confused about that. I've like had green papaya in dishes. But would you go to the market and buy a regular papaya that just isn't ripe?
It's not ripe. That's
it?
Correct. There's no difference in the type of papaya or anything. It's just not ripened. So it's firmer, it's not as soft, and it's a little bit more bitter, but it's actually really great in a salad, especially if you kind of balance it with things that have a little bit of sweetness to them. So we shave the papaya in very thin, long strips, as well as butternut squash, which is sweet to kind of balance it out. And that is seasoned with nam plop, which is a vinaigrette, essentially using fish sauce, lime juice, ginger, garlic, and brown sugar. And we will toss the papaya and butternut squash with that. And then it's garnished with the skirt steak that you saw us grilling earlier that's been marinated with soy and brown sugar and cilantro and orange and all these wonderful flavors. That's sliced very thinly on top. And then we will put our peanuts on there with a little bit of Thai chilies. They are very spicy, so a little goes a very long way. Crispy rice noodles to sort of add to that texture. And then a little bit of freshly torn mint right on top.
Great. Should we go back out?
You know, when you're cooking with something that has meaning and history and a sense of place, what does that mean for you?
You know, a lot of the times people know that I'm from the South and sort of associate me with peanuts. I really sort of have a connection to it. In maybe a way that a lot of people don't, because I have seen where it comes from, I've seen the people that grow it, and I've personally picked it out of the ground and done a lot of different things with them. So I love peanuts. I think they're definitely in a way, like a staple in America in a lot of different ways. You know, you think about going to baseball games and things like that. A lot of people are eating salt roasted peanuts. Here in the South, as readily available as boiled peanuts. And that's something that is a cultural staple. You know, they're on roadside stands everywhere. And it's just something that's comforting, familiar, and always going to kind of be around and delicious.
Why did you choose East Atlanta Village?
So we actually all live very close to it right here. And so it's an area that we are very familiar with, comfortable. We love the vibe here. It's a very cool place full of exciting and different people who are very true to themselves and true to this neighborhood, which is just a quirky, funky place where people like to have fun.
So why banshee?
A banshee is not really a negative connotation, but in Irish folklore, it was a spirit that would come to warn you that someone in your family was about to die, which sounds kind of ominous, but if you sort of have that foresight or warning that it's coming, what are you going to do but seize all the opportunities and try to have no regrets? And so for us, it was stop talking about opening a restaurant and just do it.
That is Nolan Wynn. He's chef and co-founder of Banshee in East Atlanta and a James Beard Rising Star Chef semifinalist. You can find more on the restaurant at gpbnews.org. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. A bill to ban abortions after a doctor detects a heartbeat is now headed to the Georgia House for a final vote. Governor Brian Kemp says he plans to sign it into law. Opponents of abortion hope the bill will be a test case that makes it to the U.S. Supreme Court and overturns Roe versus Wade. It is an historic moment when a Georgia law could bring a substantial ruling in the court. And it's happened before. The same day that the Supreme Court decided on Roe v. Wade, it also ruled on a companion case from Georgia called Doe versus Bolton. That challenged the state's policy of only allowing abortions under certain circumstances and challenged who could approve one. Atlanta senior judge Dorothy Beasley represented Georgia for the case. We asked her for a look back.
From CBS News headquarters in New York, this is the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy during the first 3 months belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government.
My name is Dorothy Toth Beasley, and I am now a senior judge of the state of Georgia, having served on the State Court of Fulton County and the Court of Appeals of Georgia. I was the lead attorney representing Arthur Bolton and the other two defendants in the case.
We'll hear arguments next in number 70, 40, Doe against Bolton.
In the case of Doe versus Bolton, this is unlike most challenges to the statutes in that there was another being involved. It was not just the woman and the hospital abortion committee or the doctors or anything like that. It was that underlying all of this was the state's effort to protect fetal life. If this one didn't pass constitutional muster, we say, probably none of the existing laws would, because this one was more liberal towards abortion than many were. It was not a complete ban on abortion, for sure.
Mrs. Beasley.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Underlying this suit is an appeal by pregnant women to the federal judiciary, and particularly this court, for an enunciation that they have a right, secured by our Constitution, to procure the destruction of their living, unborn children.
Standing before nine white men, was quite a challenge. I had to do the argument by myself.
The state is parens patriae here, exerting the sovereign power of guardianship over persons under disability, standing, as it were, in loco parentis, or in place of the parent. Here the mother, in defending the unborn child.
We were surprised, we certainly were surprised, because the decision that was written determined that, yes, there would be a right to abortion without question up to a certain point. Many, 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 many people, hundreds of thousands of people were interested in the outcome, and particularly since it was Georgia that was the law passed by our legislature that was declared unconstitutional.
New York State, among others, already have liberalized abortions. Now the rest of the country must follow suit. The White House offered no comment, but President Nixon has always strongly opposed liberalized abortion. Other opponents are now talking of a constitutional amendment to reverse today's ruling.
This issue of abortion, like some other issues, will never be, in my opinion, finally decided, because there are so many aspects to it and so many interests in it, and it's a religious, moral, economic, social, medical. There are just so many facets to it. But deep down, of course, when the rubber hits the road, is how far can a woman go from seeking what for her is a medical procedure?
That was Dorothy Beasley, now a senior judge in Atlanta. She represented the state in a companion case to Roe versus Wade. It was called Doe versus Bolton. Both were decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1973. And that story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. We will, of course, be following the bill in the Georgia legislature that would outlaw abortions once a doctor detects a heartbeat in the womb. Macon's Ocmulgee Mounds are now in a National Historic Park. The area was a national monument. It earned an expanded designation under a law President Trump signed earlier this month. The park is also exponentially expanding in size. It's going from 702 acres to nearly 3,000. The Muscogee people built the Ocmulgee Mounds more than 1,000 years ago. They also identify as the Creek Nation. GPB's Grant Blankenship has been following the story from Macon and joins us with the latest. Hello, Grant.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Very well. Interested in hearing about this. I've never been to the Ocmulgee Mounds, so people who haven't seen them, could you describe them?
Sure. We'll start with the Temple Mound, which is sort of like the centerpiece of the place. So imagine an earthen pyramid, and then you come through with a big knife and just lop off the point. So it's a flat-topped trapezoidal pyramid. And that's pretty typical of these Mississippian-era sites. That's the larger name for this culture, the Mississippian culture. But what makes Ocmulgee unique compared to other Mississippian sites are the place they call the Earth Lodge, which is sort of a subterranean council house that has this enormous bird effigy kind of molded into the clay of the floor. And then further down, you talk about the expansion, we're expanding into this section, there's a spiral mound. It's just what it sounds like. It's a mound that's got a spiral running up to the center that's down in what is now swamp, and that's part of this expansion. But more than what you can see now, what's really cool about the place is when you're, say, imagine you're standing on top of the Temple Mound.
Mm-hmm.
To the west, you can see Macon, but if you look to the south and what is now this sort of woody, swampy wetland, that's where the big expansion is taking place, and that's where people lived. This is a place called the Old Fields. It's where food was grown. It's where day-to-day life took place. And that's being preserved is really kind of the big piece of the new park expansion.
So let's get a little bit more history about, like, when these were built and how long did they actually take to build these various mounds and earthen houses?
Okay, so this time period, it runs roughly contemporaneous with the Middle Ages. This was sort of at its peak around 900 AD. To build any one of these mounds, none of them were built like in a day, right? So these were built over many, many years and by hand. I mean, people literally taking baskets full of dirt, building these mounds up strata by strata. But more than the how, like the why is what's really intriguing about this culture. Yeah, so you have no idea how long I've been waiting to tell people this on the radio. The why is what's sort of a mystery. Like, people were farming in the South before the Mississippian culture, but what happens in this culture is corn becomes something people grow. It's traveled somehow from Mexico, and when it gets here, it produces all these food surpluses that fuel this new culture, this and all this public building, right? And so that's the mystery of this culture. What exactly was the tie to Mesoamerica, to Mexico, to all these other civilizations? How did that inform the larger culture of the place, the art, the, what people believed? So that's why Mississippian culture is such a cool thing to kind of take in.
So they'd gone from sort of traveling nomadic culture, staying in one place because they had a crop to provide food and then could make mounds.
Well, yeah, but they grew stuff here, too. Sidebar, for all you cotton farmers out there, the pigweed that chokes your cotton fields was actually one of the core foods that people grew in the South before corn was ever here. It's a kind of quinoa for all you Whole Foods shoppers. The people of the South are way ahead of you. But it was corn that made possible this civilization.
All right, so this main mound, you said the Great Temple Mound. Now, temple confers meaning to us as contemporary humans. Do we know if it was used for some spiritual purpose?
Right, yeah. So the temple mounds were believed to have been the places where the principal chief of the community lived, like literally on top of them. And these chiefs were considered divine, right? This was an inherited title, but they were tied to I don't want to get too much into the cosmology of it because it's not my place, but this was a divine right sort of thing that led to the leadership of these communities. Now, in the time between the height of this culture and today, a lot of the meaning of what those mounds are about was sort of lost.
Mm-hmm.
As to what people today feel about those mounds and how they tie them into their religious observances, that's nothing I can speak to. But these mounds were sort of like, if you could combine the Vatican with Capitol Hill, that's sort of the function of these in these old communities.
You spoke with Crystal Parker. She's a former intern working as a program specialist. This is in employment training and the Creek Nation. Now, here she is. She's explaining why she studied Native American studies at the Tribal College of Muscogee Nation.
Sometimes, as a Native American, we're always searching, and especially us in Oklahoma, since we've been moved, and our history is kind of scattered out, so it will definitely help me understand myself and to better, you know, my path in the future.
So the mystery not solved there, certainly, by Crystal. In fact, she's talking about continuing to search as a member of the Muscogee Nation, which is now based in Oklahoma. How did the Creek, or why did the Creek, abandon the mound site?
Yeah, so there's a whole lot of history between abandoning the mound cities and removal to Oklahoma. But starting at the mound part of it, there's a 1-2 punch that was kind of at work. So remember, we're growing corn in great abundance to fuel these public works and this sort of complicated society. There's pretty good evidence that there was a cooling period, climate change in the news again, but in this case, cooling, that led to conditions that made it tougher to grow corn. And so those surpluses in some of these cities began to be hard to come by. And so, in fact, when Europeans finally come through in the 16th century in this part of Georgia, people weren't living at the main Muscogee site. They were living at the smaller Lamar site that's further downriver. So that's the first part of the punch. The second part of the punch is Europeans themselves, right? So we all know that when Europeans came to the Americas, they brought all kinds of nasty diseases. And after the 16th century on, those diseases just ripped into native populations here. So, like, you figure you can't have Hong Kong with a population of 10,000 people, right? It takes mm-hmm. a certain number of people to fuel a city. When the populations plummeted, the cities became impossible to maintain, and the landscape was just more sparsely populated.
How about when it was populated? People lived at these sites for hundreds of years, so it was one of the biggest settlements in the region. What was life like there?
Well, so these chiefdoms would have had smaller towns connected to them. So, you know, there's a possibility that Muscogee could have been a paramount chiefdom with a bunch of other smaller towns attached to it. And these larger chieftains were often quite big. Like, think the entire Tennessee River Valley from a little bit south of Knoxville down to Chattanooga, or the entire Coosa River Valley. So these were these were polities in sort of the way we think of states. Not quite, but it wasn't just sort of a loose conglomeration of people the way you may think of native settlements in history. They grew corn, beans, and squash, the three things that, you know, we all know from our own gardens. And if you like grits, they had a version of grits. The towns were highly fortified, and part of that may have been because of this climate change and food insecurity. There was a lot of low-level warfare between the towns, especially about the time the Spanish started coming through. And beyond that, we don't know. I mean, we don't know exactly what they thought, what they believed, because they didn't have a written record of the things they did and how they lived. It's all sort of inference.
You know Grant Blankenship as GPB's reporter based in Macon. Well, apparently he knows a lot about archaeology. And we're learning a lot of that from him today. But onto the sort of politics of this, the site did become a national monument in 1936. Congress actually wanted to make it a national park. Why did it not get that designation to begin with?
Well, I mean, back then it was the throes of the Depression. And, you know, they wanted to set this 2,000-acre boundary for the place, but there just wasn't the money to purchase the land at the time. And so, you know, we've lived with this smaller, more circumscribed version of the place since then. And so now, boundary has been redrawn again. We have this opportunity to make it contiguous. And again, take in the old fields. I mean, it's one thing to see the big structures, but the places where people lived, where life took place, it's wilderness kind of now. It's this river corridor. You know, there's bears out there. But this new park is going to take all of that in.
So has that ever been excavated thoroughly, or has it been left in place, as some Native American sites have, to not disturb?
Well, the main site has definitely been excavated. The part, when you go in the front door of the now park and you find the Temple Mound, yes, that entire park was excavated back in the 1930s. I don't know if the smaller site, the Lamar site, has ever been fully excavated. And I imagine that people in Oklahoma kind of hope, if it hasn't been, that it never is. In fact, in recent years, some things that were taken from the mounds during archaeological digs mm-hmm. have been returned. And that includes people who were never intended to be removed from the earth have been brought back home. And that's a pretty big deal for the Muscogee Nation to have been able to do that.
You interviewed Samantha Kuhn. She visits the site often. Her 90-year-old grandmother is Muscogean. Here she is describing what it's like to share photos from the mounds with her grandmother.
She speaks all in Muscogee, so, you know, it's a lot more coming from her, a lot more meaningful coming from her. But, you know, she said, you know, even if I can't go, you know, at least I get to see it. And so, you know, I'm excited for this second trip around because my grandma knows about Facebook. And so she called me. She was like, "Are you putting it on Facebook?" And I just laughed and I was like, "Yeah, I am.
Well, there's a switch. The recent expansion and improvement will be part of a tribute to Native Americans who first came to the historic site during this Paleo-Indian period. So how are Natives and community celebrating the milestone there?
Oh, well, I've lost count of the ribbon cuttings. there was another one just last night with the principal chief of the Muscogee Nation, Johnny Isaacson and Sanford Bishop, the legislators who, you know, really were behind pushing this through Congress, were here last week also celebrating. It's just a happy thing. I think for preservation for people here locally in Middle Georgia, you know, people believe in this. This has never been anything that's divided this community. Everybody cherishes this place. And I think it's pretty unique that a community like this can also sort of work in tandem with a Native community that is here in absentia to preserve something as important as this.
GPB's Grant Blankenship, another side of Grant Blankenship. Thanks so much for your help.
Hey, lifelong dream fulfilled. Thank you, Virginia. I appreciate it.
Speaking about the Ocmulgee Mounds National Historic Park, more on it at gpbnews.org. Thanks so much for being with us today. This is On Second Thought.